So, hello everyone, my name is Sina Arnold and I would like to warmly welcome you to tonight's event in the name of the Berlin Institute for Research on Integration and Migration here at the Humboldt Universität. And first of all, a very heartfelt thanks to the Haus der Kultur in der Welt for hosting this event here tonight with us. And it is an event, the presentations are part of an international Cosmos Summer University that we are currently planning and conducting with several colleagues and friends from Berlin, from Italy, Australia, the United States, and several other places. And some of the people involved in planning this event you will encounter on the stage here tonight. And the title of our summer university is Investigating Logistics, Lifestyles, Migration, the Commons. Now, logistics is a bit of a cumbersome term. It brings up images of ports and containers, of algorithms, of tracking devices. And in our summer university, we want to explore how logistics can help us understand current developments in global capitalism. So after all, logistical processes are what help facilitate the global flow of commodities and of labor power, that is people, to circulate with greater efficiencies. But logistics, in our view, can also be helpful in understanding contemporary migration. So one of the alleged scandals in the contemporary media discussion around refugees in Germany was the fact that a lot of the newcomers had smartphones with them. Now, rather than a sign of wealth, this points to the fact that modern refugees need to be somewhat logistical entrepreneurs using apps to navigate the departure, the trip, the arrival. Logistic knowledge is needed to cross the Mediterranean and is needed to cross the English Channel. But logistical predictions and analysis are also applied to monitor, to redirect, and to stop migration flows. In that vein, the Süddeutsche Zeitung recently called the management of 7,000 refugees arriving at Munich main station in one single day a logistical masterpiece, praising the interplay between relief agencies, the police, NGOs, and volunteers. So tonight, we are happy to present and discuss some first ideas on this interplay between logistics and migration. And in the course of the next almost 3 hours, we will first hear Merle Kröger read from a new novel, Havarie, in German, and then that is followed by a translation in English from Rubaika Jallivala. And afterwards, we will take a short break. There's pretzels and drinks. The drinks are available for sale at the bar. And then in the second half of the evening, Sarah Kalkayali will introduce Lale Khalili, who will then take us into the world of container ships in her talk, which will last for about 40 minutes. And afterwards, Manuela Boyagiev will facilitate a discussion, and we are happy to have comments from Sandro Messadra, from Michael Hart, from Brett Nielsen, and from Ned Rossiter. And of course, we value your comments, your questions, and other contributions in that discussion as well. And then the whole event will finish at around 9:30 tonight. So I wish you a pleasant and stimulating evening. And I will pass the virtual microphone over to Birgit Zornin.
Yeah, thank you, Sina. My name is Birgit Zornin. I'm also part of the organizing team of the Summer University and this event. And I'm very, very happy to be here with Merle and Rubaika and to moderate the reading. And I will introduce them both now. Merle Kröger is the author of various novels and screenplays, and she is also the producer of various films, which she has done together with Philipp Schäffner and her film production team Pong. And I only name a few, for example, The Half Moon Files, The Day of the Sparrow, and Revision. I would love to have more time to tell you about these wonderful films and also the novels which she wrote before Havarie. They are called Cut, Kiai, and Grenzfall, but you will have to look it up in the internet or read the novels and see the films because we don't have time for that. We have a huge program here. So her films and novels won many prizes, and for example, Havarie was the top of the criminal novel bestseller list of the Zeit for several weeks. And it also won the Radio Bremen Krimi Prize 2015. She also works as a curator and also teaches at several art and film universities about screenplay writing and
everything.
Okay. So now a little bit to get you into the picture of the book Havari, for those of you who haven't read it. It is based on an investigation in the Mediterranean, which she has done together with Philip Schaffner. And another outcome of this research is also a film, which they are currently editing these days. It will be finished. And the title of the film is also Havari. And interestingly, Merle told me today that there's actually no translation into English, like literal translation, for Havari. But like the technical term for a major accident on the sea would be general average.
Maybe someone will object or say it's true, but we heard that.
Yeah, that's what, yeah, you told me. So the starting point for the investigation was a short clip they eventually found on YouTube, which documents the encounter. It's a handy film. It documents the encounter of a cruise liner with a small rubber boat, which was filled with people who were trying to cross the ocean in this rubber boat. And actually, in the novel, this huge cruise liner is called Spirit of Europe, which is an interesting like picture to imagine this huge ship called Spirit of Europe and the small rubber boat of people who are trying to get maybe to Europe. So after that, they saw this clip, they started a research and found out about the details of this encounter. So they tried to find the people who were involved in this documented scene, and then from this they came to other real and possible encounters in the sea or in the Mediterranean. So that's also what came out of this, is for one in the realm of literature and fiction, is the criminal novel Havari, which involves four different types of ships and the perspectives of 11 persons who are for some time or on these different ships. And so it talks about their perspectives, their views, and their conditions and histories. And Havari reflects on many of the aspects and questions that were also important in our discussions and research on logistics. And I hope we can then, after the talk, also relate to that of Lali. And it talks about the conditions of labor, for example, in the logistics of transporting of people and things and goods. And it tells different, partly interconnected histories of those people who are moving in the Mediterranean for different reasons. And we are reminded of the fact that all these histories are connected to political histories, like the history of colonialism and the realities of post-coloniality, of migration, of war, of industries, but also the very personal and individual biographies of the people who are moving on these ships. So you will hear some of it in a minute. And I'm also very happy to introduce Rubaika Jaliwala. She is working, she's a program developer at an international youth NGO, and she's working with this in Berlin. She's also a trainer for workshops on intercultural learning, human rights, education, and diversity management. And she's the translator of academic, literary, art, and cultural text, and also film subtitling. She has already translated one other novel of Merle, Cut. And now she, for this event, she actually translated some chapters of the whole first part of Havari, so that we can have this lecture in German and English. So Merle will start a little bit of reading in German, and then Rubaika will read her translation. Okay, so now I give.
Thank you, Birgit. To you. Thank you. We thought that we that maybe less boring if we just I start in German and then Rubaika will read the whole chapter in English. Then I start another chapter in German and she will continue in English so that you get an idea of how I would read my text in German and then you can understand what Rubaika translates. And thanks a lot. It was really a pleasure actually because we worked on it together and Rubaika did it all in the nighttime because she was working all day and so we had long nights of discussing the rhythm of the text, so it was great for us as well. Thanks. So this is the book, Havari. We will read three chapters. Spirit of Europe, Deck 12. I have to switch to German now, sorry. Spirit of Europe, Deck 12. Lalita Mazarangi und Joseph Kisson. Die Dolphins at Dawn spielen den allerletzten Song auf der Bühne in der Mitte des Pools. Keine Zuschauer mehr da. Ach doch. Das Mädchen im geblümten Hosenanzug hockt neben der Plastikpalme und glotzt seit Stunden in die Spiegel-App ihres iPhones. Der gekrümmte Körper eine geballte Niederlage. Die Freundinnen weg, kichernd hinter irgendeiner Tür zu den Innenkabinen. Und der Junge, mit dem sie früher am Abend auf Deck 5 gesehen wurde, als noch alles glitzerte, auch weg. Die Luft dampft. Weiße Schwaden ziehen über das Schiff. Es stinkt. Einer hat in den Pool gekotzt. Jedenfalls schwimmen da faserige Stückchen auf dem Wasser. Entenkeule in Trüffelreduktion, Empfehlung des Tages vom Küchenchef. Das Mädchen richtet sich auf wie in Zeitlupe, taumelt schlingernd zwischen Stapeln von Liegestühlen davon und verschwindet im Dunst. Lalita steht ganz, ganz dicht am Rand des Pools und summt mit. Joe singt Tagalog. Hat sie gegoogelt, weil ihr langweilig war und weil sie immer wieder an den asiatischen Jungen mit den Dreads denken musste. Er singt mit seiner richtigen Stimme jetzt, die Augen zu. Keine Coverversion, kein antrainierter amerikanischer Akzent, keine zweite, dritte oder vierte Haut. Lalita schwankt. Oder schwankt das Schiff? Diese verdammten High Heels, 12 Zentimeter samtig ummantelter Stahl. Egal, sie hat ja frei. Lalita Mazarangi, Security Team der Spirit of Europe, melde mich zum Dienst, 8 bis 20 Uhr, zweimal halbe Stunde Pause plus extra Stunden. 7 Tage die Woche, 3 Monate lang, 1 Monat frei. What a fuck. 19 Tage hat sie heute geschafft. 1,5 Mal erfüllen sie sich ihren Traum im westlichen Mittelmeer. Mach die Augen auf, Joe. Sieh mich.
The dolphins at dawn play the last song on the swimming pool stage. There are no spectators. Oh yeah. The girl in floral pantsuit, perched beside the fake palm tree, stares into her iPhone's mirror app, a figure crumpled in defeat. Her girlfriend's gone, sniggering behind the door of some inside cabin. And the boy, with whom she'd been seen earlier this evening on deck 5, when it all still glittered, gone as well. The steaming air, white clouds billow over the ship. It stinks. Someone threw up in the pool. At any rate, thready bits float on the surface, duck leg in truffle sauce, chef's recommendation of the day. The girl straightens up as if in slow motion, staggers off between stacks of deck chairs and disappears into the mist. Lalita stands close, very close to the pool and hums along. Joe sings in Tagalog. She'd Googled it because she was bored and because she kept thinking of the Asian boy with the dreads. Now he's singing in his real voice, eyes shut. No cover version, no cultivated American accent, no second, third, or fourth skin. Lalita sways, or is it the ship swaying? These bloody high heels, 12 centimeters of velvet-coated steel. Whatever, she's off work now. Lalita Mazarangi, security team of the Spirit of Europe, reporting to work 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., 2 half-hour breaks, plus overtime. 7 days a week, 3 months long, 1 month free. What the fuck? She's worked 19 days today, 1.5 times. Make your dreams come true in the Western Mediterranean. Open your eyes, Joe. Look at me. Joe opens his eyes. The house between rice fields north of Manila disappears slowly like an image in a dream. a last glimpse at Grandma Bella propped up on her walking stick, the sparkly eyes on her wrinkled face piercing him, Joseph with the Negro hair, evidence of a passionate love affair with the American in the forests of Mount Arayad, breathless, fleeing from Japanese fascists. Gurkha girl, that's his name for her. She's dressed to the nines. Hell yes, she looks cool in her uniform. Black trousers, green beret, guerrilla style. The bling miniskirt and high heels are cheap. Gurkha girl as a Nepali bitch. Eyeshadow too blue, curls too fake. The frosty look gone. Something promising instead. This turns him on. Her eyes are closed. She sways to the rhythm. Joe turns around. Raymond on bass smiles and nods. It's your night, Joe. Joe without an E. Joseph, not Joe. For once, break loose. Three times a day, 2 hours of pop music, only UK and US charts. Only from the playlist sent by Gold Cruise's head office in Miami. Only G-rated. Only the most boring shit in the world. You may look like Jimi Hendrix, but the old gals only want Bob Marley, got it? No woman, no cry, at noon in the Maharaja Lounge, afternoons in the Star Lounge, nights on the promenade deck or the poolside, as per orders. 7 days a week for 10 weeks, 3 weeks off. Today is the eighth day of their third trip. Today, Joe looked the Gurkha girl in the eyes and whispered, Anak. The stares of the other three burn into his back. The song can cost them their contract. But Joe knows they can't resist the appeal. For once, break loose. For once, be yourself. One more time, the refrain of the Filipino mega hit. Then silence, roaring, the wind, louder. Hey, far louder than before. Gurkha girl trips in her heels and smiles sheepishly.
Östlich von Gazouet, Algerien. East of Gazouet, Algeria. Karim Yassine. Karim steht auf der Spitze des Felsvorsprungs und sieht auf das dunkle Meer hinaus. Das Kribbeln ist wieder da. Gefühlte 2 Zentimeter unter dem linken Schulterblatt. Seit er die Gürtelrose hatte, juckt es da ab und zu. Schlechtes Vorzeichen? Ach komm, alter Mann. Einfach nur ein Signal deines Körpers. Der will noch mal los, der will Gummi und Salzwasser riechen. Das Blut in den Adern rauscht, Delfine jagen neben dem Boot. So fühlt es sich an, wenn man lebt. Algerien ist Stillstand, ist tot. Ein scharfer Windstoß reißt ihn zurück in den Augenblick. Unten am Strand leuchtet das Feuer viel zu hell. Daneben die Männer, die im Lichtschein ihre Sachen zusammenpacken. Sie sind unruhig. Die Haraga, les brûleurs, die ihre Pässe verbrennen.
On the edge of the cliff, Karim looks out to the dark sea. The tingling sensation is back, about 2 centimeters under his left shoulder blade. Since he'd had the shingles, it itches now and again. Bad omen? Oh, come on, it's just your body sending signals. It wants to take off again. It wants to smell rubber and salt water, blood coursing through its veins, dolphins hunting beside the boat. That's how it feels to be alive. Algeria is a deadlock. It is death. A strong gust of wind tears him back to the present. Down at the sea, the fire glows far too bright. The men are packing beside it in the glare. They're nervous, the haraga, les brûleurs, who burn their passports. One of them looks up, points towards the hidden boat. Karim raises his hand. They're all waiting for his signal. He's the oldest. Allah, how time flies. He's doing the journey for the sixth time. No one has done it so frequently. Karim takes a decision. If the wind dies down in the next 10 minutes, they'll set off. If not, they'll pretend for another night to be harmless men on a camping holiday. Young men wasting their lives away because they have no future, not here. They're the children of the black decade, black as this night. The wind has abated. Karim pulls the outboard engine cord, which roars to a start. Loud, brutally loud, it reverberates in the rugged mountain faces. Nothing like getting away from here. He steers the boat so his back is turned to the mountain. Like a shadow, it emerges from the darkness. Karim knows. He does not turn around. He senses the mountain, its bulk, its magnitude. He can sense the invisible mountain as well, growing out of the ocean floor and separating the water about halfway between Africa and Europe. Surah 25, Al-Furqan, verse 53, Quran. Legend has it that Jacques Cousteau discovered the watershed. He then converted to Islam. The men on board the Calypso, mysterious underwater universe. Karim has seen them all, reruns on Algerian television. World Without Sun is his favorite film, probably because the title matches so well with his world. Even before the GPS is activated, he senses the presence of the extinct volcano northeast of Almeria. Cone-shaped rocks point to the sea like fingers, showing him the way to the bay where he will end up, smack in the national park Cabo de Gata. Three mountains in 14 hours, if all goes well, inshallah. The moon briefly highlights the faces before disappearing behind a cloud. At the bow, the two distant cousins from Oran, who he last saw as children. The teacher from Algiers beside them. Abdelmajid from the store in Gazawe, where his mother buys her dates. The two boys from the neighborhood. Their brothers have been in France since a while. Karim was in school with them, and damn, why the hell is he still here? The other five from the village at the end of the bay were dropped into his lap by the chap who sold him the dinghy. Three boats for the price of two. But Karim won't be part of this new scam of multiple takeoffs. Three set off, one makes it. The unlucky ones drown in plain sight of the Coast Guard. Algerian roulette. You're getting old, Karim Yassin, 38 years in autumn, old and anxious. Zora noticed it first. They Skype daily if the internet connection works. Don't be impatient, Karim. Don't be afraid. We'll find a way. The fear never again to sink his face into her hair before his life ends. It drives him across the sea. Promise me you won't do it again ever. Her face is pixelated over Skype, but still, she's scared as well. He can see that. He promises. He doesn't keep his promise. Not a good start to a marriage. I promise you, Zora, it's the last time. The journey and the lies. If not, there's no future for us at all. White seagulls appear silently out of the dark, circling the boat. Karim follows them with his gaze nearly hypnotized by the ghostly birds. Again and again, they approach a 180 degrees turn in the air, and they nosedive into the foamy waters the engine leaves behind in the troughs of the waves. Here comes another one. Flaming feathers over the Black Sea, a white glow, streaked in a matter of seconds by a sliver of light. Watch out, Coast Guard. Karim changes course. Shots whip across the sea. Don't be scared, they're just warning shots, he calls out to his people. The cousin at the bow disappears in the dark. Panic. Brother, where are you? The spotlight casts a beam of light in the darkness, twitching as it searches across the sky. We have to get away from here. No. Despair echoes in the night. Engine noise, beams of light. They're very close. Over there, Abdelmajid's face next to his. Karim leans to the left, looks past Abdelmajid, a wall. Their escape lies behind the wall of fog. He keeps on it blindly, and they already plunged into it. The howling of the wind dies a fast death. The fog belt becomes a three-dimensional field of white light. It spreads out, longing for eternity, lapping against the contours of their small boat. Karim stops the engine. No one says a word. They all have the same thought. If he's lucky, they'll pull him out of the water in time. If not, the other cousin, face buried in his hands, mourns silently until the fog swallows him up.
Spirit of Europe, deck B3, Marwan Fakhouri. Eine Ladung schmutziger Laken kommt aus dem Rohr geschossen und landet auf dem Boden, weil er wieder vergessen hat, den Wagen darunter zu schieben. Marwan fühlt die Panik aufsteigen, immer von unten nach oben, aus dem Bauch, enge Gefühl im Hals, Hyperventilation. Die körperlichen Symptome sind ihm geläufig, kein Spiegel nötig, um sich selbst dabei zuzusehen, wie er bleich wird und die Hände zu zittern beginnen. Dieser grauenhafte Lärm und die Hitze, der Schweiß rinnt ihm von der Stirn. Er wischt sich mit dem Ärmel über die Augen. Eine so vertraute Geste. Nichts hat es ihm ausgemacht. Doppelschicht im OP, kurz schlafen, dann weiter. Kein Zittern, niemals.
A load of dirty sheets shoots out of the pipe and lands on the floor. He'd forgotten to move the cart underneath again. Marwan feels the panic rise. Always bottom to top, a gut feeling, lump in the throat, hyperventilation. He's familiar with the bodily symptoms. He needs no mirror to watch himself at it. How he turns ashen and his hands begin to tremble. This dreadful noise and the heat. Sweat runs down his forehead. He wipes it, running his sleeve over his eyes. A familiar gesture. Nothing had mattered to him. Double shifts in the OR, a short nap, then continue. No trembling, never. The girl from China pulls up the metal rack and starts collecting the laundry. Her face is blank, her body slender and sinewy. She could be 17 or 30. They've been working together every night side by side since almost a month, but she's never spoken to him, not a word. The Chinese laundry crew changes every few weeks. Most of them are men, a few women now and again. Initially, Marwan made umpteen attempts to talk to them. He tried in English, but the reaction was always the same. Smile, shake of the head. And anyway, here below, it's so loud. Some machine is always spinning that you can hardly understand your own words. The Chinese come and go. Marwan and OK remain. Of course, we have only ourselves to blame. We're the accursed on this dead ship. We've been dead for a while. We need nothing. No daylight in the laundry, no daylight in the cabin, no daylight in the crew canteen. A quick smoke outside in front of the training room. A brief glance at the sky, perfect holiday weather, not for us. The dead need no holiday. The ship rolls under him, Marwan's stomach revolves. He noticed that he got seasick only after a few weeks. At first, he was doing fine. He was relieved to have escaped the dinghy to be at a safe place, for starters, downright euphoric. Later, the dizziness began. He began to tread gingerly, always this feeling in his head not being completely himself. The constant nausea. He eats, he can't keep anything down. He eats, he forces himself to eat. Machine 14 in the rear stops. It's one of the big drums for the sheets. The sound starts unbearable, piercing, this digital whistle. Marwan trudges over, opens the drum. The whistling stops. Hot steam pours out towards him. He draws back. He pulls up an empty cart from the left and begins to wrench free the damp, tangled sheets from the machine. If at least they could slave away together, he and OK, the boy from Lagos. But the cabin is tiny and they have only one bunk bed. The foul air is barely enough for one. One works, one sleeps. The sheets appear to be stuck together, or perhaps Marwan's sore hands are simply too weak. Hands of a surgeon. When he received admission to study medicine, his mother had examined his hands for several minutes. My son, the surgeon, pride of the nation. Bah, there's nothing left of it. Not even if he concentrates can he suppress the trembling. Now Marwan only operates on the upper bunk bed during sleepless hours of darkness. Regardless of whether it is day or night outside, the cramped cabin musty from perspiration, cheap air conditioning and chemical detergents. He struggles against forgetting, searches a wound, amputates a leg. Yet the images are getting more blurred. Exhausted, he lets go of the tangled mass of damp cotton. A fresh attempt? Leave it. Did she just speak to him? Did she? She pushes him aside and untangles the sheets in three hand grips. Do that there, it's easier, she points to the rotary iron. Marwan looks around, all are slaving away silently. Now and again, someone wipes sweat off. He feels as if he were hallucinating. The Chinese girl takes his hand and places it on the rim of the meshed cart. She points again to the rotary iron. Marwan smiles. When was the last time he'd smiled? He cannot remember. It feels strange to pull up the corners of his mouth. She does not smile. She turns away and goes back to the pipe to fetch new feed for the eternally hungry, monstrous washing drums. Marwan leans briefly on the wall. Slips of paper hang across from him, like everywhere here below in the labyrinthine innards of the ship. Next Monday is payday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. every 2 weeks. The last time, he'd fallen asleep in the queue. He did not even wake up when they finally called out his name, Jordan Baker. Security had taken away his passport at the time, and somehow, on the way to the personnel department's computer, Marwan became Jordan Baker, American citizen with a valid social security number. Okay is Jordan Baker as well. They're sharing the name, so to speak. In any case, no one here is interested in your name. Laundry night shift, a nameless person. An advertising leaflet beside them for the offshore money transfer system around the world. The rate is worse than at Western Union. But he and OK have no choice. They cannot disembark at the next port. So they send money home every 2 weeks. Now and then, on rare occasions, an email. Sorry, dear mama, for not having written in so long. I finally found work on a ship. I had no time to look for a flat in Spain. I'm assistant doctor on the night shift, mama. I have to start from scratch, but what can I do? The replies of his mother are long and always circle around the same topic. She complains about fatigue. There is nothing else to report on life in the Syrian Mediterranean coast. Waiting for father to return from work, waiting for the war to end, waiting for her son to return home, waiting for grandchildren, waiting. OK started with the lies. He claims that's what his family wants. No one at home in Nigeria is interested in stories of failure. Failure is a private matter, reckons OK and laughs. Every week he sends lengthy reports of his life on this luxury liner, that he started out as a temporary waiter, then became bartender, and now after 3 months is already dining room manager. Enough brooding. One can't ever be sure. The Indian has installed cameras all over the place, a creepy guy who never sleeps, always prowling along the passageways in his quiet, springy gait, with nothing but empty promises in his pockets. Maybe next week. We're negotiating. Miami is negotiating. No one wants to have you. Who knows what he'll do to someone who doesn't work properly. Marwan pushes himself away from the wall and takes 3 steps forward. He takes a sheet from the basket and inserts it slowly into the drum. If he makes a mistake, the ringer will halt. Slowly, centimeter by centimeter, the cotton disappears into the rollers. The smell reminds him of his childhood. The laundry in the courtyard just behind the house. A pipe in the wall, white steam, day and night. Sun on the red bricks, his cat. He waits a moment, then grabs the sheet again from below. It's smooth and fresh as if new. That's how he'd like to restart his life, a new beginning. In this moment, the ship rolls, the dizziness begins again. Marwan lets go of the sheet, staggers sideways, grabs onto nothing, and slams his head against the frame of the clothes rail, nailed to the floor like everything on the ship. The Chinese girl jerks her head around as if she'd known something like this would happen. All the others continue to work. Darkness.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So nice to listen to your own book.
Yeah, that was really impressive. Wonderful to hear this. Like, I had the text in mind of the book and then hear your translation. Great. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
So now there's time for questions. Do we have a microphone in the room or?
Whoa. We can get one of ours.
Yeah.
But it's always.
There's one.
There's one. Sometimes it's a bit hard to. Yeah. Come up with questions directly after a reading.
Yeah. So maybe we just talk a little bit. I just thought because we don't have so much time for questions, I give you the opportunity, but well, I have like more of a comment than a question, but I'm sure you can say something about it. It's, for me, it was so impressive to see how you elaborate the figures and you give them a history, and especially the case of Marwan. I found it especially interesting that, for example, you didn't characterize so much the people who were in the boat, in the rubber boat, but then the history of Marwan and his friend, who's also working there on the ship, becomes so plastical because, and it was for me so great how you told this story, because this person wasn't where we would think he would be, maybe, after all the reports in newspapers and the media and all the pictures we see from people who are refugees. He is working on the ship. He's part of the logistic of transporting other people, of having people their lovely holidays, enjoying their lovely holidays on the cruise liner. And so I was wondering how, on the other hand, it's so obvious that this is like this, but it was really exciting for me to read this in the way you show what happens there on the Mediterranean.
I mean, maybe it's a two-part answer. The first part would be that, first of all, I think the idea to have 11 persons who all have an equal weight in the story, equal importance in the story, came actually from the from that first moment where we found this YouTube clip, and then got in touch with the guy who filmed it, and he was on the cruise ship, and he is an Irish guy in Northern Ireland, and of course you think, oh yeah, there are the ones up there and then the ones down there, but In the first point already, it totally went upside down, my idea, because he is a guy who comes from Belfast, and he filmed them because he was thinking about his youth in a civil war situation. And I thought, okay, be careful. If you want to write about the situation, you have to look into everyone's history. And then I realized that this is the only way, actually, for me, to get on eye level, to have not to change the perspective from that looking down and looking up into something which can be on the same height. If you look at yourself and you think, okay, I am not, my history, my biography is not free of violence, of war, of migration, then I can look into someone else's eyes and can look into his or her story. So this is the first part of the answer, I guess, why these 11 people. And the second is that actually it's like the world. I mean, there is the outside world, which is the Mediterranean. There are cargo ships, there are Coast Guard ships, there is cruise ships, and there are rubber boats. But then inside the cruise ship, there is something like the capitalist world, like essence of the capitalist world again. And I wanted to have, for example, that guy who comes from Syria, Marwan, he's a doctor. He managed to escape, he managed to cross the Mediterranean, but then he ended up in this world, and somehow he's totally lost there, because it's like an abyss. It's like the worst form of capitalism and loss of identity which you can encounter. It's like a model. It's not, I mean, I don't know so much about what's happening in the down decks of the real cruise ship. I was on a cruise ship, but I, of course, wasn't allowed in these parts. But it's like a model for me. It's like an essence. So that's why I wanted him there. Mm-hmm. Long answer. So.
So any other question? Yeah, Lali?
Yes, I hope so. It's very difficult as a German writer to find an
English language publisher either in the UK or in the US. So we just started out on this, and now we have a sample, thanks to you people, and thanks to Rebecca, first of all. And we'll send it around, and of course my publishers, they are a small, independent, left-wing, feminist, upright publisher in Hamburg, and they are just three people, so they don't have someone who's there all the time to sell rights to the... But I hope so, yes. I would really like this one to be translated also for my friends to read it in English. Let's see.
Thank you very much for the reading, for writing the book. I read the book in the summer, and I was struck by many things, but particularly by the kind of intertwining between history and geography in your narrative. It seems that taking the sea as a kind of privileged perspective allows you to make connections mm-hmm. between histories that are usually imagined as not connected. I mean, from Northern Ireland to history of colonialism in India, from the First World War to the Maoists in Nepal. And the kind of impression I got reading the book, and I was following this kind of thread, was that history itself became liquid in your narrative without losing reality. In a way, I am very much interested in this kind of encounter between history and geography, and in the way in which taking the perspective of the sea on history allows you to see connections that you usually don't see. And so I was wondering whether you have some reflections on this point.
Thank you, first of all. In a way, yes. When we started this project, we thought a lot about the sea and what it actually means and what it has become in the recent times. Actually, that was long before last year, so it was, I mean, this what's now on the news is a reality for many, many years here, but it was not so much an everyday in the news that that boats were found on the Mediterranean, although they were there and we knew about it. But what we thought was... how can we turn the sea, which actually is seen right now as a border situation, but in actually can't be a border because it's a sea, it's fluid, you can't, I mean, of course you might be able to erase some fences in the sea, but it would be very difficult. So it's a fluid situation, and that's a space of possibilities for us. And that's the way how we try to see it. It's like also a kind of resisting that idea that the sea can be a border, so that we explore it as a space of possibilities. Of course, it's also a space of realities because these encounters do happen, and they do show a certain hierarchy of views. Point of views. I mean, there is the ones who look are up on deck 12 and the ones who are down in the little boats. But so, I mean, one can't just conceptualize it into something, but at least stop the whole thing, stop the whole idea of the images we see every day and explore that space. And for me, it's like I recently gave an interview and I came up with the idea that for me, my book is like a 3D model. I stop. And these two boats, I mean, in reality it was as well like this, they lie next to each other, they lied for like 90 minutes, feature film length. And these 90 minutes I take in my book, and I take it like a 3D model, and I look onto it and into everybody's biography for as long as I think is worth looking at it.
Do we have another question or comment?
What? Well, I guess I have the obvious question, and this is in which way this work is based on research, and how do you actually did you actually conduct your research?
You want the short or the long? I think we are. Okay, the short version is yes, of course, all my work is based very much on research, because I'm an author and a producer of documentary films in my other life. And so I actually started writing because sometimes in documentary filmmaking, I, for myself, very personally missed a kind of space where I can, which I can push forward into fiction. So I started writing. And but it's very much based on research, and what we do usually is really like the Schneeballsystem. So we take like the YouTube clip, and then we go on to the person who shot that clip, and from that person we go on to the cruise ship, which at that point was part of the whole situation. So there we start talking to the people who were on board, and we get all the different versions. We collect the versions of that event. And the event can be very small, like this one. And then if you feel like, okay, this is the event, but actually I'm interested even further around, you start looking at what could have happened next to this event. For example, like, what could have been the cargo ship which passed by while these two were meeting? And then we found out, for example, now I'm trying to put the link to the cargo ships industry. I mean, there were, of course, cargo ships around, and all the people from Algeria to whom we spoke, they met really often they meet cargo ships, of course, more than cruise ships. And then we found out that on cargo ships, most of the officers are Russians and Ukrainians, and they work together very closely. There are 15 people on board. And we became very interested in that situation, because that's, again, a contemporary war situation, which is, you can locate it within the Mediterranean Sea. So that's how we expanded the research. Yeah, to give you one example.
Thank you.
I lost my microphone. So if there's no other question, we just make a cut here. And I'm very happy about your last answer, because this also gives us a great idea how we can research, because what you are doing also in the other novels and in your films, I would call this perspectivity. It's like a methodology to look from different perspectives on a scene, and that is what we also want to do in our researches, and we try that. So that's really inspiring.
It's great fun, yes. Yeah.
Okay, then now we make a break. Maybe we can have 10 to 15 minutes. You can go out and have a Brezel, and then you can have drinks at the bar, like Sina said, and we will be back in here maybe at 7:40, okay?